This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The public radio family lost a great one yesterday. Millions of listeners came to know Carl Castle as the steady voice of authority who brought us the news of the day, and along with it, a subtle reassurance that no matter how bad things sounded, it was all going to be okay. For me, Carl Castle's death marked the passing of a friend and revered colleague as well. I had the great privilege and pleasure of working with Carl in the NPR newsroom. He was the consummate professional, and he taught me a lot. He could quickly identify suspect information for more critical review, a vital skill when accuracy is everything and time is of the essence. He was artful in his ability to break down complicated stories without dumbing them down. And he was at his best when most of us crumble. On those days when all hell was breaking loose and the pressure was crushing, Carl kept us all together with a calm, dignified, professional manner that reminded us that we were all in this together. He taught me grace under pressure, and I am deeply grateful to Carl Castle. The classic horror story Frankenstein turns 200 this year. The iconic book spawned countless plays and movies and has reframed how we think of power and the power of scientific creation. The novel also drew attention to author Mary Shelley's own intriguing life. Today we celebrate Frankenstein's bicentennial, and we begin with the story of its author, Mary Shelley. Joining me now is Deanna Koretsky. She is a professor of English at Spelman College, who specializes in 18th and 19th century literature. Deanna, welcome to the State of Things.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Tell us more about Mary Shelley, because here's a woman who was born to 18th century intellectual royalty, right?
Absolutely, yes. So she was born to a woman named Mary Wollstonecraft, who is commonly considered to be one of the first, if not the first, feminist philosophers. And to boot, her father was William Godwin, an anarchist political philosopher. So she had the unusual benefit of an incredibly sophisticated education for the late 18th, early 19th century, an education that women really weren't supposed to get. She grew up reading things that even her own mother could only have dreamed about. And by the age of 16, she fell in love head over heels with one of her father's political followers, the poet Percy Shelley. Now, what's crazy about this is that Percy Shelley, who was 22 when Mary's 16, was already married with a kid on the way. Everybody that they knew completely shunned their union. So they run off together to the continent, travel around for a couple of years with Mary's stepsister in tow, Claire Claremont, and eventually settle around in Switzerland, where Lord Byron has a summer home and is sort of hanging out, vacationing, doing weird things. This was, Mary Shelley tells us much later, a cold, ungenial summer, not a lot of opportunity to go outdoors. So they're sort of cooped up inside thinking about all kinds of fancy philosophy and reading ghost stories. And Byron gets the idea, let's all write a ghost story. Scariest one wins. And so this becomes...
Well, I do want to get to that, but I also want to point out that this union at the age of 16 with her 22-year-old beau, Shelley, who is, it results in at least a pregnancy and a child, right?
Yeah. So Percy Shelley's first wife, Harriet, was pregnant when they left England. They come back a couple of years later with Mary pregnant. So this was the scandal to rock all scandals.
All right. And now let's talk about the cool summer in Switzerland where this she gives birth to this novel.
Sure. So 1816, June of 1816, they're hanging out in Switzerland. It's cold, it's wet, it's ungenial. Nobody wants to go outside. Right. So they're sitting around reading ghost stories and they start to write ghost stories. Nobody really finishes it except for Mary Shelley, who wakes up one morning in the middle of the night, having seen what would eventually become Frankenstein's creature open his dull yellow eye.
It came to her in a dream, or so she says, right?
Or so she says, right.
Yeah. Had that story changed over time? Because I think I have read that the story, it got a little bit more polished and perhaps a little bit more detailed with each telling in terms of where the vision for this story and where the germ of the story began.
Well, absolutely. By 1831, she was a sort of literary celebrity in her own right. And 1831 is the moment where she really writes the introduction to the second edition that everybody knows, where she tells this very composed story about Switzerland and German ghost stories and the contest. Where it actually came from is really anybody's guess.
We've come to see the story of Frankenstein, and she even calls it the modern Prometheus. It's in the title. So she cues us to one of the themes, which is this danger. And of course, we're talking about now this is the flower of the scientific age, right? And the possibilities of humans taking control now are just beginning to percolate. You've got romantic artists like Shelley and Lord Byron, who are also thinking about these things. So it's in art, it's in culture, it's in science. So the idea of how far we can take this and how dangerous it might be certainly is on her mind. But this business of childbirth and what it means to be a mother and what it means to bring life into the world is also important to her, certainly a theme in the novel and one that may not be as well discussed.
Yes, absolutely. So by 1816, she had already lost one of her children. And by the time the book was published in 1818, she had lost two more. So they had a total of four children, only one of whom would survive into adulthood, Percy Florence, the fourth child. So certainly on top of the fact her own mother died 11 days after giving birth to her, definitely she was deeply haunted by the loss of her own mother, the trauma of giving life. She saw life and death not so much in the terms that probably most of us think of them as polar opposites, but really as almost interchangeable. One for her yielded the other, and that's definitely part of the book.
Talk to you about the fact that she wrote this book at the age of 18. It's an ingenious piece of literature. It's a triple nested story. It's a story within a story within a story, not to mention some of the gruesome and also romantic details, which are sublime. How remarkable or revolutionary a book was this, just in terms of literature, by 1818?
A pretty remarkable, I would say, on a number of levels. I think just the fact that we're still talking about it 200 years later gives us a small sense of how many themes she managed to register in roughly 150 pages. In terms of, you know, sort of the revolutionary politics of her own day, this was, among other things, it was certainly working in a kind of proto-feminist vein that her mother started. I think it was also pretty explicitly an abolitionist text. So you mentioned the story within a story within a story. The literal core of the story is the creature's story, the creature's narrative, which mirrors very closely some of the slave narratives that had been published that were very widely known in England around the turn of the 19th century. So certainly she's starting to think about race and the processes of racialization, how British society constructs its what they consider to be its others, how British power maintains itself through the construction of otherness, through social exclusion. So themes that are really, you know, still very much hot topics for us today, she's already beginning to think about in 1816. At the age of 18.
And in that context, too, the notion of love and how that looks. And again, very much in the context of social construction, who gets to tell the story, and right, and then how we fit into that construction of reality and social hierarchy. But also the notion of love. I mean, Victor Frankenstein rejects this creature not because it has done any harm. He just doesn't like it aesthetically. It's ugly to him. It is something other than what he had expected. It violates his sense of what things should look like if you go and create a life, right? Which is a fairly ephemeral look at, I mean, all, and all the creature's asking for is companionship, which it learns through reading. And so this gets back to your notion that ideas of slavery and slave narratives, how we learn to read, how we learn to be socialized, is a very important theme in this book, right?
Absolutely. Percy Shelley, a year before Frankenstein, wrote a funny little essay called On Love, where he starts to theorize love, and this is kind of maybe a window into their relationship. He thinks that the ideal love is someone who almost exactly resembles himself. And that is very much from the jump what Victor is looking for when he meets Walton, the explorer, he likes Walton because Walton reminds him of himself, and the creature could not be more different, which is maybe the primary reason he rejects him and will not love him.
So it's not so. So it could be seen not so much as a warning about the power of our intellect to destroy us, but the power of narcissism and the way we tell stories. And narcissism and intellectual creativity are not the same things at all. Of course.
Absolutely.
Fascinating stuff. So I want to talk about the revision. I've got about 30 seconds here, and we'll have time later. But 1831, she revises the book, and it's fairly substantial in some ways. Talk about that revision.
It is. It's very substantial. I think they're two different stories. 1818, she's talking about human choice and the morality of choices. Victor very much has the choice to love his creature or to reject him, or even to make him or not to make him. By 1831, and this has a lot to do with the many, many personal losses that she suffered, Victor is a slave to larger forces, forces like fate and nature, that really make him a pawn of something much bigger than himself. I would say that's the major change. There are also some smaller structural changes, surface level changes, small plot points. But the major thing is the novel becomes much more fatalistic, much less about exploring human choices as such, and much more about human beings in the context of larger things that we'll never understand.
Well, we are going to continue our conversation about the novel Frankenstein, its author, Mary Shelley. Deanna Koretsky will stay with us. She's a professor of English at Spelman College who specializes in 18th and 19th century literature. We'll continue the conversation looking at popular culture references today and, yeah, science. Talk about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. We're broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. Mary Shelley's classic novel Frankenstein turns 200 this year, but much of what comes to mind when we think of Frankenstein and his monster is actually from those iconic films that emerged well after the book. You think of that square-headed corpse with bolts in his neck. He grunts, stomps around in the dungeon of the mad scientist with the bubbling cauldrons and beakers and the electricity snapping back and forth. This week, Science Communicators of North Carolina and the Duke Initiative for Science and Society are hosting a special Frankenstein edition of Science at the Movies. Now consider how films have influenced the way we think about science. And joining me in the studio are three panelists from the event. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University and our go-to movies expert. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Rodolphe Barangu is a geneticist and a professor of food science at North Carolina State University. Rodolphe, welcome.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. And still with us, Deanna Koretsky, a professor of English at Spelman College. Her specialty is 18th and 19th century literature. All right, let's talk about the first Frankenstein movie, 1910. Right?
Let's do it. So this was a Thomas Edison Company film. It was a one-reel film, which means 10 to 12 minutes. It was, of course, a silent film. As your first segment discussion notes, this is a really complicated novel with a lot of different layers and a lot going on. How do you do this in 10 minutes, right? And the answer is you condense it tremendously. So the two most interesting things to me to think about filmmakers trying to imagine is the creation scene, right, the science, and then also what the creature looks like. And so for this first foray into representing Frankenstein, I think one of the interesting things about the creature is that he looks kind of like a caveman with long, crazy hair, right. And it's really not the image that we think of at all when we think about it. And the other thing that Edison does with this film is instead of having it end the way that Mary Shelley ends it, he ends his one reeler with a kind of happy ending where Frankenstein literally gets to live his life happily with his bride, and the creature that he has created disappears into thin air.
Well, and of course, Edison has a far different set of goals, right? He really isn't trying to reflect the complexity of the novel. He's trying to show off his technology and then maybe make us a little more comfortable about where technology might lead. So the disappearance of Frankenstein might be the perfect ending if you're Thomas Edison.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that he does in this film that that I think is particularly interesting in terms of the look is he really prefigures in some ways the aesthetics of the German Expressionists would pioneer a decade or so later. So his creature has these creepy long hands, and there's a lot of kind of smoke and shadow. And so he's also, I think, trying to scare his audience a little bit.
Deanna, let's talk about this. The film, I mean, the film version that comes to mind, of course, is the Boris Karloff edition with the bolts in the neck and the square head and the scar. But the fact is there have been many renditions owing to the fact that while it is clearly described in the book, it really does what that creature is, this mashup of corpse parts, really does leave a lot to your imagination, doesn't it?
Absolutely, it does.
And, of course, the one thing we know is that it was shocking enough, so it didn't look pretty. And that was the thing that Victor Frankenstein pretty much knocked him unconscious when he first saw the thing move, right?
Right, yeah.
All right, so it's a big thing. So, Rodolph, I want to ask you, 1910, this is nearly 100 years after the original book was written. How popular were these ideas of electricity? Because this is one of the things that certainly animates the monster. What were people really thinking about this and the potential for electricity to probably reanimate life?
Energy, power, life. This is what distinguishes things that are alive and moving and animate and energetic versus those that are not. And the concept of electricity in science has been very popular for a long time. People relate to light bulbs and waves and sounds and pulses. You think of today as being alive, being defined by having a pulse versus not having one. So science and technology and electricity are very much aligned. That's a very good way to send a strong message of what technology can do to create life and keep life or bring life back.
Yeah, well, and Deanna, even in Mary Shelley's time, weren't there experiments that she was aware of? These were sort of the beginnings of Galvin's experiments with electricity and making frog legs jump, right?
Yes, exactly. So that's, she very explicitly notes that in the 1831 introduction that Galvanism was a direct influence on her. Erasmus Darwin was also grandfather of Charles, was also thinking about spontaneous generation. And so some people have suggested that that's where she got the idea to write a story about the production of life without a female body.
I want to move into the science and come back to you again, Rodolph. The idea that you talked about energy being the basis of this, electricity was sort of in physics the first kind of great discovery and things people played with. Are we understanding this in a different way when we look at genetics now? It's not just about the zap that goes through us, but really what is energy if we're trying to get to the root of life?
So now we think of life as DNA. You know, who we are, what we do, how we work is very much driven and designed and determined by our genetic content. And if you think of, you know, how would we go about doing the Frankenstein circa 2018, if you think of a scientist trying to create life, design life, assemble life, rather than use organs from, you know, dead animals and dead people and dead things and use electricity to drive it, we would do it synthetically in a genetic lab. We would use tools like CRISPR and molecular biology to engineer things in the lab, create life in the lab, and then, you know, design it, assemble it, and make a new puzzle made of simple DNA letters, A, T, C, G.
How close are we to that sort of thing? And let me ask you, if we start just from the beaker, do we synthesize all of it, or would we be better to start with something that's already living and mash it up a bit?
So we can do it either way. We can do it very effectively, very efficiently, very precisely, and even now, very affordably either way. You can create life de novo using chemistry and biochemistry. There's people like George Church who are assembling de novo a human complement of the genome that is chiral, that is purely chemical. Or you can take splices and pieces of existing DNA puzzles and then assembling them into something that has never existed before. And what's interesting and relevant today is that we are already at a point in time where scientifically we can create new organisms that do not exist, such as bacteria, but increasingly so, chimeric organisms.
Chimeric is what?
Chimeric, made of different species.
Ah.
So think of growing a human organ on a pig. Think of taking a gene from, you know, a salmon, putting it into a tomato. You can come in now and assemble and mix and match different pieces of DNA from different species. We're able to do it. It's easier to do than it's ever been. It's faster to do than it's ever been. And importantly, it's more affordable than it's ever been.
So how much of that is going on right now?
It's going on all day, every day, in tens of thousands of labs doing genetics around the nation and around the world. It's the democratization of molecular biology.
Well, I want to get back to some of that, and I also want to see culturally how we have viewed these, not only this kind of progress, but also culturally what we were thinking of it. The next big step for Frankenstein in the movies is 1931, so that's 100 years after the big revision. Tell us about that movie.
Well, this is, of course, the big one that looms in everyone's mind when you picture the Frankenstein creature played by Boris Karloff, who is the iconographic version. And this was a Universal Studios film. They were producing these wonderful horror films like Dracula in the 1930s, and it adds a number of new plot elements, one which is particularly, I think, delightful and relevant, which is Frankenstein's lab assistant, which, of course, you can always blame it on the lab assistant, who breaks the container holding the brain originally intended for the creature and covers it up by stealing an abnormal brain. And Frankenstein does not know this. And it's got a much more elaborate animation scene. It's the one that really brings in the electric, energetic, scientific aspect much more, of course, than the Edison version and much more than the novel, which does not go into tremendous amounts of detail about the creation.
Well, let's play a clip from that 1931 version of Frankenstein.
Look, it's moving.
That's a clip from the 1931 classic film Frankenstein. I'm here with Diana Koretsky, a professor of English at Spelman College, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State, and Rodolphe Barangu, who's a geneticist and a professor of food science at North Carolina State University, all participating in an upcoming panel on science in the movies at Duke University's Griffith Film Theater at Bryan Center at 7 o'clock on Thursday. So talk about some of the images, because those are the lasting images. You say Frankenstein, it still comes to mind.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I mean, in this idea that comes across even in that short clip of the assumption of godlike powers and the kind of mania that comes with it, I mean, that's certainly an idea we're still grappling with today. What does it mean to kind of take on this kind of generative force? But I, in terms of the kind of the mechanisms, it's got this Metropolis-like universe of all these kind of gadgets and the bolts and illumination. This is the thrilling part of the animation of the creature.
And, you know, our good friend and colleague, John, and your colleague, John Kessel, is sitting in the green room. He's about to come on and talk about his new novel. But he pointed out that 1910 version, here's Thomas Edison, the father of modern electricity, right? I mean, the guy who should have been promoting that. There's none of that buzzing and zapping is going on. It just sort of appears in
a
poof of smoke.
No, it's a very laboratory, different kind of concept of powders and smoke that happens in the first version for whatever reason that he chose. But this is certainly the enduring one. And I think one of the interesting facts about the 1931 Frankenstein is that they actually shot two versions, one in which Frankenstein dies in the end, as he does in Mary Shelley's novel, and the other in which he lives. And they went with that one because of very Hollywood reasons.
It's
about
Hollywood.
You got to keep your protagonist alive.
Diana, how much of that theme, the idea that these godlike powers would be the death of us, that would lead to our doom and destruction, how much of that was part of the discussion in 1818 and beyond after the novel was published?
It is absolutely part of the discussion. Frankenstein in the novel, not as heavily as he does in the film, but he does think about that for a minute. He does think about himself as the creator of a new species that will worship him like a god until the creature's eye actually opens and then he freaks out and runs away. And that has definitely been a theme in the many stage versions that were put on across the 19th century. The assistant actually comes out of the very first stage version from 1823. The 1931 film, picks up a lot of the staged Frankensteins from across the 19th century and just sort of makes it more spectacular and more modern for movie viewing audiences. But it picks up very much the same themes that Mary Shelley and her contemporaries were already starting to think about.
Yeah, the line in the novel, "How dare you thus sport with life?" I mean, that is
right.
The question.
But it's interesting too, Diana, that the adaptations of this began just a few years after the novel was published. Say 1823 was the first stage adaptation, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So there was interest in this. How much of it changes over time? Do you get a sense of sort of different eras emphasizing? Because it, as we've said, this is a complicated book, many, many layers and many themes. Do you get a sense of what people are interested in at a different period of time based on the emphasis that you might have seen in various adaptations?
I think absolutely. I think that's so much of the reason why the book has endured. She registered so many different things that were going on in her lifetime that people from across the last 200 years have sort of cherry-picked depending on the cultural moment. So the 1931 film picks up, among other things, some of the anxieties about the eugenics movement happening in America and overseas, and that becomes kind of a catalyst for the makeup and the costuming of the monster. Later iterations pick up more on the themes of gender and gender equality that are going on in the novel. So you can almost track the development of 19th and 20th century cultural thought through various film adaptations of Frankenstein.
Rudolph, let me talk a little bit about one of the themes that has been then played out not only in Frankenstein, but in certainly in film that was spawned from the Frankenstein scene and those iconic lab scenes, that of the mad scientist, counseled by the more, you know, cool-headed scientist around him that this is madness and it will lead to destruction. You're doing this work now, right? This is the kind of work you're doing. But it seems to me, not Frankenstein. I get it. But what kinds of discussions around sort of what are we doing and what are the consequences of this? Do those kinds of conversations go on? Is there time for that conversation?
Big time. Mm-hmm. And we need to make more time to talk about this, because what's great for movie, what's great for the audience, is a very strong message about, you know, stereotypical old white male, all powerful, narcissistic, eccentric, God-playing scientists that can create life, which is great for movie yet again. But in terms of how science is perceived in general, how scientists are perceived in particular, you know, this is a challenge that we need to overcome in an era of genome editing and genetic engineering and creating life and manipulating the DNA of viruses and things like plants in our food supply chain or gene therapies and altering human embryos. There's a lot of loaded questions about the science itself, about the motivation of scientists, and about the perception of science from society. And I think nowadays, in a world where arguably imagination may be the only limit as to what we can do with DNA, what we can do with genetics, what we can do in terms of breeding and crossbreeding and engineering and redesigning genomes, maybe the biggest hurdle that lies ahead of us is acceptance of science, and perhaps actually acceptance of scientists by society.
But there are things to worry about, though, aren't there? I mean, it's more than just a public relations question, how we can get people to understand what it is we're doing. Things can go wrong, and once the genie's out of the bottle, we could be in trouble.
Things can and things do. Yeah. And this is why the whole lab environment, yeah, right, containment, biological containment, there's a lot of movies that talk about, you know, risk and viruses and, you know, dead, right, people roaming around. And I think the concept of containing science and driving scientists and controlling to some extent what they can do, how far they can take it, whether they should do or not do it, and then where they can do it. And now it's a very global world where technologies are democratized, right, widely available, openly available. There's a lot of open source, you know, tools people can use and get their hands on. Citizen science,
right,
you know, and
well, and there's a lot of bad guys who are in charge of whole governments these days who could do bad things, and as you know, the leader of that nation could direct people to do those things. We've seen it when tampering with our elections. These are people who have the vast apparatus at their fingertips. And others.
Well, and this is still, I mean, we still see this idea recurring in science fiction, which is such a sign of the power of a great novel. I was just teaching my students in a superheroes class about Logan, a recent Wolverine film, and it's the same idea, basically, this idea about responsibility to your creations, people using, even if it's for whatever purpose, for something nefarious, and what's your responsibility? Is it to the creations? Is it to the larger society? And that's what's so resonant about the novel.
Yeah, Diana, let's come back to that theme. One of the most powerful themes, and the one that gets, in my mind, talked about the least, or certainly represented the least, and that is, what is our responsibility to that which we bring into the world, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, talk more about that.
I was just going to say, it's very much the implicit theme of every single adaptation that I've ever seen of Frankenstein. It is, you're right to say, it's one of the ones that gets talked about the least, and that perhaps is a question for us to deal with now 200 years later.
Well, and how do we do this? Because it's interesting, because I'm going to talk about the next adaptation. I want to play a clip here from Young Frankenstein, or should I say Frankenstein. but let's talk about that, because of the way it's been adapted, it's almost become its own farce. Let's listen to this.
Dr. Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
You're putting me on.
No, it's pronounced Frankenstein.
Do you also say Frodwick?
No, Frederick.
Well, why isn't it Frodwick Frankenstein?
It isn't. It's Frederick Frankenstein.
It goes on, Young Frankenstein. I've only got a couple of seconds left, Marcia, but have we gotten past the point? Has the thing become such an icon that it's now we're not making more serious use of it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, in this case, this Mel Brooks remembers seeing this film as like a kid when it came out, and this was kind of his way of being terrified, I think, of reconciling some of that childhood trauma, and it's like a love letter in the form of comedy. So, but yes, obviously, this is not grappling with the same issues as the other adaptations we've talked about.
Deanna, it's still having an effect and a serious effect and a serious impact, that book, on us today?
I would say yes, actually. There are, aside from just the film adaptations, there are a number of adaptations in many, many media still coming out. There's a great comic book version of Frankenstein called Destroyer that came out a year ago that actually sort of revises it to help us to think about Black Lives Matter. It's the premise of the story is a 12-year-old black boy is shot by Chicago police, and his mother happens to be a direct descendant of Victor Frankenstein and uses the sort of family secret, family technology to bring him back to life. So it is absolutely a story as much of the 19th century as it is of our own day.
Deanna Koretsky is a professor of English at Spelman College, who specializes in 18th and 19th century literature. Rodolph Barongo is a geneticist, professor of food science at NC State. Marcia Gordon, film professor at NC State as well. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
You can catch Marcia, Rodolph, and Deanna at Science at the Movies. It's a panel at Duke University, and we've got the information at our website, stateofthings.org. The Frankenstein conversation continues with local author John Kessel in a moment. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. For two centuries, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein has captured the public imagination, and it's left many of us with questions that go beyond the pages. What if Victor Frankenstein had made a bride for his monster? What would a modern Frankenstein story look like? And what would happen if you dropped Frankenstein and his monster into a Jane Austen novel? Actually, John Kessel is the only one who ever asked that question, and his answer is his new novel. John is a science fiction writer and a professor of creative writing in American literature at North Carolina State. His latest book does combine a novel of manners with the world of electrified corpses. The book is called Pride and Prometheus, and he joins us now. Welcome back, John.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Jane Austen and Mary Shelley meet in the pages of your book. What got you thinking about this?
Well, I was at a writing workshop, and another writer there, we were critiquing each other's manuscripts, had a story that was a satire of Jane Austen. And somehow it came to me that Jane Austen, I realized that Jane Austen and Mary Shelley were contemporaries, and that Pride and Prejudice was published in 1811, and Frankenstein in 1818, they would have been on the bookshelves of many homes at the same time. And yet you could hardly think of two more different novels. And so the idea that these two things coming out of the same culture, the same time, same place, two women writers, Jane Austen is generally considered to be one of the progenitors of the novel of manners. Mm-hmm. Jane Austen prefigures Henry James and Edith Wharton, people like that. And then Mary Shelley is considered one of the founding mother of science fiction. And these two genres go off in different directions. And yet what would happen if you put them together? Is there any way in which they might talk to each other? What kind of contradictions or similarities might there be if you tried to fuse the two kinds of genres? And that's what really intrigued me.
So tell us about what happened when you did this. Give us a sense of the outline of this book.
Well, basically, what I chose to do was to have a Jane Austen character fall into the plot of Frankenstein. My main character is Mary Bennet, who is the middle of the Bennet sisters of Pride and Prejudice, who at the end of that novel is unmarried. And Mary is very awkward and essentially clueless, a young woman who plays the piano and reads sermons and is very moralistic and is presented as the butt of the joke most of the time in Pride and Prejudice. It turns out, actually, that in Frankenstein, Victor, after he's created the creature, he's blackmailed by the creature, who threatens to kill all of his loved ones if he doesn't create a bride for him. And in the book Frankenstein, Victor goes to England and travels about gathering materials, and then goes up to Scotland to create the female monster. One of the towns he goes to is a town of Matlock in Derbyshire. And it turns out that Matlock in Pride and Prejudice is near Darcy's estate in Derbyshire. So this was seemed to me meant to be, that somehow Victor could encounter the characters from Pride and Prejudice. And so I have Mary Bennett meet Victor. She's in her early 30s at this point and is on the brink of spinsterhood. And she and Victor like each other, which surprises both of them.
All right. Well, let me ask you to read from the novel, and we can talk more about it. This is John Kessel. The book is Pride and Prometheus.
Okay, this is from the scene where they're at a ball, and Mary's only there because her mother insists on it. And she gets asked to dance by Frankenstein, and they have a conversation afterwards. "So, Monsieur Frankenstein, did you come to London as your friend Mr. Clerval did on business?" He sat across from her, his cup in his hands. Other couples in the room conversed with various degrees of intimacy. Looking about as he spoke in his excellent English, he said, "I came to meet with certain natural philosophers here in London. Your country boasts some of the leading chemists of Europe." "Oh, have you met Mr. Davy?" Frankenstein looked at her as if seeing her for the first time. "You are acquainted with Mr. Davy?" "I'm not acquainted with him, but I am, in my small way, an enthusiast of the sciences. Have you read his discourse introductory to a course of lectures on chemistry?" Frankenstein's eyebrows lifted. "I find myself astonished to meet a young woman who has read Humphrey Davy. Is this the pastime of well-bred ladies in London society?" For the first time in their evening, he seemed to be animated by something other than duty. Mary felt unaccustomed daring. What did it matter what she said to a diffident foreigner whom she would never see again? "The well-bred ladies of London are more interested in Mr. Davy's good looks than in his writings," Mary said. "The well-bred men, though they may attend his lectures, are for the most part less interested in his writings than in the well-bred ladies. You and I are likely the only man and woman here tonight who will speak of chemistry."
Writer John Kessel reading from his latest book, Pride and Prometheus. It's Frankenstein and Pride and Prejudice in the same pages. By the way, one of the great pickup lines of all time, John, and I'll remember this one. "Have you read his discourse to the course of lectures in chemistry?" I'm going to use that, I think.
I think it's always works. 100% successful.
But it's a wonderful thing that you're doing here because, again, you two very different styles, obviously, and they go in very different directions as the generators of different kinds of literature. But both, in essence, about love. Love is a very important theme and our responsibility to those who we fall, and how we fall in love, right?
Right. One of the things that attracted me was Jane Austen's novels are all about, superficially anyway, about finding the proper mate.
Right.
And Frankenstein, a large part of the story is motivated by the creature's desire for a mate. So this, again, is sort of about the marriage plot, trying to find someone who is appropriate to you, and also finding how there are people who are rejected for reasons that are not always very fair.
No, I mean, that's right. Frankenstein, he's not Dr. Frankenstein, in fact. Victor Frankenstein rejects his monster because he's ugly. I don't like the way he looks. So what more superficial reason could there be?
Right, exactly. And the creature in the book, which doesn't really translate to most of the films, it seems to me, is one of these immensely articulate. He's brilliantly intelligent. He's agile and physically superior in a way that the creature in the movies tends to not be shown.
And he's learned about learning. I mean, this is a sort of a fascinating thing to me that you read in the book, that this is a creature who has a kind of metacognitive understanding of how important it is to learn these things. And Victor Frankenstein just grew up with it in the same way that the aristocracy in Pride and Prejudice don't quite know how they got where they are.
Right, right. And I think that the creature is an outsider, and so he can see human society in a critical way. He's kind of a social critic. And I think Mary Shelley intended this. He's the original blank slate, born innocent and corrupted by the way he's treated by a human being.
So as you're bringing these two books together, how much are you going back and forth? Are you toggling between novels? You're having to create your own third way here. What's going on in your mind?
Well, one thing I did was I divided the story into three points of view. So most of the book's from Mary's point of view, and those parts are sort of the Pride and Prejudice parts of the book, where the style is more like Jane Austen. The other points of view are Victor's point of view and the creature's point of view, and those are written in first person, more in the Mary Shelley style. And so when I switch points of view, that automatically shifts me from, say, the novel of manners to the Gothic. But as the story goes on, Mary basically falls into the Gothic story, and she ends up doing things that no Jane Austen heroine would ever have to do.
Good job, John. Can I have you read again for us?
Sure.
Read another section? This is interesting because this is the confrontation where the monster meets the maker, I think.
Yes, it is. Victor, of course, has to find a female body in order to create a mate for the monster, and so he prowls about some graveyards. And so this is from the creature's point of view, who's been spying on Victor as he does all these things. He prowled through the graveyard, the light from his lantern narrowed down to a beam, until he found a fresh grave with a simple wooden cross at its head. He set the lantern on the ground nearby and began to dig. I hopped lightly from the wall and crept up on him. "Victor," I whispered. To my great satisfaction, he jumped a foot. He swung around, the spade clutched in his hands. "Have a care, Victor. You'll wake the vicar." He rested the blade on the ground. "How long have you been spying on me?" "A very long time. I have kept myself invisible in order to allow you to work with a calm mind." "A calm mind? Better I should never see you again." "I am pleased that at last you act on my behalf. I had thought you might spend all your time with this woman you seem to have taken up with. Twice now have I spied you with her. What purposes does she serve?" "That's none of your business." "On the contrary, all that affects you affects me. I am here to help. Who is this Miss Bennet?" He stiffened. "How do you know her name?" "That is none of your business." "You shall not harm her. She is nothing to you." "About that, you are right. The question is, what is she to you? Does your Elizabeth know about her?" He winced as if I had laid a hot iron across his forearm. "God damn you," he said. "God has already damned me," I said.
John Kestel reading from his novel Pride and Prometheus. This is the mashup of Jane Austen's novel and Mary Shelley's novel. First of all, can I tell you how much I love the line, "Have care, Victor, you may wake the vicar." I just love that because it brings in so many ideas. I mean, this sort of religion and don't wake the – let's not bring that into this question. It's great stuff. And you, as I say, you bring all these things together. Eventually, Mary falls into the Gothic novel. When you're imagining these two ideas about love and romance, one of the things that comes to mind for me is the way the monster acts as a kind of conscience for Victor and asks him to think about things that apparently he'd never considered before in terms of his responsibility. He seems to, for a pretty recent creature, have a well-developed conscience.
Yes, I think Victor, in some ways, Frankenstein, it seems to me to be part of the book anyways, about parenting. Mm. And Victor's a very bad parent. He's the guy who creates a child and then abandons it immediately because he's offended by it, put off by its appearance. And so the creature keeps trying to call Victor back to his responsibilities here, to remind him of those things. At the same time, the creature is also murderously angry. And not just at Victor, but at all human beings. So there's a real tension here between the creatures. In a sense, he has a very active conscience. In the other sense, he feels he's justified in doing the utmost violence, not just to Victor, but to any number of other people.
Were there themes that you had in mind as you took off on this project?
In a way, I just immersed myself in the characters and the situation that I had created, and then I just followed it. And it was interesting to me because mostly when I write, I tend to have things all plotted out. But in this case, I was just following the storyline of Frankenstein with the additional character of Mary put in there, and how she's a wild card in revealing things about both Victor and the creature.
I won't ask you to tell us about the ending, but it is, you know, mayhem ensues,
right,
to some degree.
Right.
And again, did you have the ending in mind, or did you kind of write this from beginning, middle, and end?
One of the things I was worried about so much was the ending, and I had a couple of different possibilities in mind. When I got to it, it seemed to me there was only one natural ending for the book, and that's the one I gave it. But readers can tell me if I was right about that.
How does Victor perceive his role in this idea of being the parent of the monster?
I think he feels that the monster has by his actions, violence. He strangled Victor's little brother. He caused Victor's family servant to be accused of the crime and hanged for it. Victor feels that the creature has lost any cause for sympathy by this point. And I don't think that's what Mary Shelley thinks, but I think my Victor is yeah, very judgmental about this.
Well, and it's interesting in the novel, certainly in Mary Shelley's novel, where we're asked to think about how one comes to that, because this is a creature who starts out by trying to save lives, but because it is cast as the other, finds itself committing violence more and more. And so one can ask whose responsibility, if there isn't greater responsibility, for the mayhem than just the monster itself.
Right.
Yeah. Let me ask you to read one more time. I think we've got enough time to get to another reading.
Okay. Well, this is a scene between Mary and the creature. Later in the book, Mary and the creature are thrown together in a trip across Scotland, and I won't get into the details of that. But Mary, as a young girl, studied music and plays the piano, and is interested in harmony. And one of the evenings when they're on the road, she tries to tell the creature about music. And in the course, she teaches him a ballad called the Bailiff's Daughter of Islington, which is a real ballad from the 1700s. So I'll start here with her teaching him the ballad. And this is the ballad verse. I prithee, sweetheart, canst thou tell me whether thou dost know the Bailiff's Daughter of Islington? She's dead, sir, long ago. Then will I sell my goodly steed, my saddle and my bow. I will into some far country where no man doth me know. Oh, stay, thou goodly youth. She's alive, she is not dead. Here she standeth by thy side and is ready to be thy bride. Mary taught him the words. It took some practice, but eventually Adam managed to carry the tune through a verse. The creature's come to call himself Adam. The next time they tried it, Mary wove a high harmony above Adam's melody. He closed his eyes and chanted the lyrics, struggling not to be distracted by Mary's harmony notes. When they got to the end, he said, May we sing it again? They sang it again and once more for good measure, until Adam was hoarse. When he got to, She's alive, she is not dead, the last time, his voice broke and he stumbled through the final lines. That was wonderful, Mary said. Adam studied her for a moment in silence. This is hard. It makes me feel things here. He touched his spread fingers to his chest. It is sweet, yet painful. These are emotions that I do not understand. Of course, he had never felt such emotions, Mary told herself. He was 3 years old.
John Kessel, reading from his latest book, Pride and Prometheus. I haven't left you much time, but I wonder if you have thought about those books, the Jane Austen book and Mary Shelley book, in new ways since you've written your novel.
I think quite a bit. It's really, I've taught Frankenstein many times in my science fiction class, so I've given considerable thought about it. But I guess I see the characters in more complexity in humanity, especially Mary, actually, who's really not a very well-developed character in Pride and Prejudice. But I had occasion to think a lot about her and make her more of a fully rounded human being in writing this book.
John Kessel, writer and professor of creative writing and American literature at North Carolina State. His latest novel, Pride and Prometheus, and you can find out more about it at our website, stateofthings.org. You can catch John reading Pride and Prometheus May 23rd at Weymouth Center in Southern Pines. And again, it's all at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Frank.
State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley's our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.